Today, we are going to be talking about the history of the formation of the Kickapoo Valley Reserve. The history of the Kickapoo Valley Reserve is a big story to tell. I think everyone knows bits and pieces of the story, but it's hard to grasp how it affected so many people in such different ways. Joining us today to help tell this story is Marcy West. Marcy West was the first executive director of the Kickapoo Valley Reserve, serving there from 1996 to 2021, so she served over 25 years. She's also the author of the book, Protecting Paradise in the Driftless, How the Kickapoo Valley Reserve Came to Be. So welcome, Marcy West. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I love talking about this topic.
Well, great. Well, you were at the KVR for the long time, Kickapoo Valley Reserve. I'm sure we'll be calling it the KVR quite a bit today. So again, tell us a little bit more about yourself. Tell us about the early years, Marcy. Tell us about your family.
The early years. I'm a native of Green Bay. So yes, Green Bay Packers rock. We moved to the Valley in 1997 after I started the job. Prior to that, we were in Madison, and I'm a graduate of UW-Stevens Point, Natural Resource Management. We really just fell in love with this area once we visited Wildcat Mountain State Park. And it's been quite a ride, but yeah, from 1997 until now, and you know, great place to be.
Well, great. I know your husband Dave quite well from being part of the community. He's a big hunter. I'm sure he's enjoying it as well.
He is. He loves it here. And you know, basically our kids grew up together, so.
Again, you know, the Kickapoo Valley Reserve, and I'm sure people listening are of all different understandings of the Kickapoo Valley, the Kickapoo Valley Reserve, why it's there. But let's get your version. Let's take it back from the beginning. We all know that it's kind of based around flood control, but go ahead, Marcy. Tell us how the Kickapoo Valley Reserve came to be.
Well, absolutely. The flood control was the start of the issue all the way back to the 1930s. Folks who had settled in the area, as you can imagine, wanted to settle next to this fabulous river for farming, logging, mills. And so now that we know what the Kickapoo is like, you can imagine that if you were that close to the Kickapoo and you had a flood, it would be a huge issue. So all the way back then, the citizens requested a dam and flood control from their elected officials, and it got studied, got kind of put on hold, well, definitely put on hold during World War II, and then obviously the number of other conflicts, but it really ratcheted up in the 60s, the proposal for the Corps of Engineers to control flooding. And again, the community had just experienced so many repetitive floods that it kept coming around. And obviously in the 60s, technology and the whole spirit of being able to control a river was much stronger. So it really ratcheted up then, and in the late 60s, the proposal was approved by Congress to build a dam just above Lafarge. So to orient everybody, the reserve exists between Lafarge and Ontario because the dam was proposed just above Lafarge to protect the downstream communities. And then there were even some proposals for smaller check dams on the creeks. And that study and the whole proposal to for flood control then expanded into economic development and recreation to attract people to the rural area and to hopefully improve the economic conditions in the area. And yeah, that was a huge initiative, and people started selling their land, or the Corps of Engineers went in and made offers to try and piece this all together. And over 149 families were purchased, some by eminent domain and some wanted to sell because of the economy. And the proposal hit some roadblocks.
Sure. And was it always, I mean, the end result or the dam that was the final solution answer for the flood control in the Kickapoo ended up to be a monster of a dam, you know, that was going to essentially flood or make a lake out of about 9,000 acres. Was that always the only proposal that was on the table? That, I mean, or, you know, you were talking about smaller check dams and things like that. Were there multiple options before they decided on the final big dam?
Yes, there were multiple options, and always the budget played a role. But, you know, Ontario did not lack flood issues as well, so there was a small dam there. There was a small hydroelectric dam in Lafarge for many years. But it's, you know, I wasn't there, so it's hard to explain. But
sure.
From what I understand, the sense of the Corps of Engineers and things that were going on in other parts of the country where engineering could build a bigger dam, they went for it. And Lafarge was proposed to be an engineering marvel, because they would intake the water, and the tower is still there, but the tower and the tunnel that would have sent the water back out, they said the water would have been at the same temperature, so it would have protected downstream environmental community, but...
The fish, the habitat,
the fish, sort of... the habitat, things like that, but mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. And so the Corps came in, and that was... You know, and correct me if I'm wrong, but that was one of the big rubs or the big disagreements, was obviously there were about 150 families that had farms and homesteads and houses and stuff like that, that were in this, you know, upstream from the dam, that they were evicted. They didn't have an option. And as you said, some people sold their homes willingly, and other people wanted to hang on. So that was a big disagreement in the community, and there was a lot of strong feelings about that on both sides. Tell us more about that. When did, you know, where eminent domain had to be enforced? Like, when was that? What were the years there?
Yeah, in the late 60s and early 70s, so there seemed to be about 4 or 5 years where the negotiations were really happening. And so, you know, I write about one of my favorite characters that I had met when I started, James Daines. And James talked about how the Corps of Engineers would come and you get a first offer, and then if you think you deserve more, they would come back again and say, you know, if you don't sell at this price, we're going to invoke eminent domain and take it at the original price you offered. So it seemed to be the Corps of Engineers, you know, they had a limited budget as well, and so they had to meet their budget obligations. Some of the landowners were willing, as I understand it, from, you know, their children or their grandchildren, but others were not, and the Corps of Engineers would come in and make an offer on the lowland that was probably going to be flooded, and when we say flooded, it was more like it would be backed up. You know, it would be just the backup in high rain events, so they just had to keep it out of construction. But those landowners, a lot of them were left with a barn and no cropland, so to speak.
Sure.
Or, you know, the connections on the roads didn't make sense, or the school and things like that. So it was just really hard feelings. And if people are more interested, there's an awesome oral history project that we did in early 2000s where we recorded some of those voices and Bonnie Sterling and a number of other people in the community put those into print.
Right, and that was another thing that I have always heard too, was many people said that the problem was that because this conversation of flood control and possibly putting in dams and all these different options had been talked about, you know, like you said, since the 30s or 40s, and so the farmers or the people that own property there, like, no one would come in and buy it if they did want to sell, you know, before the decision was made to put in the dam. So the price, like, no one would come in and buy it if a few years down the road it was going to be part of this dam project. So when it came to buy it, the land, through the government, through the federal government, you know, it was said, well, your land isn't, look at, you know, no one has been selling land. No, the value is low. So it was a real bad situation that way too. And again, many strong feelings on both sides of that.
So, exactly.
Yeah.
And imagine it with the speculators purchasing up along the ridges that were supposed to be an overlook to this beautiful lake.
Sure.
That, you know, artist renditions of sailboats and lovely scenery. So you, within the community, I mean, you could really get a sense of where the conflict would happen. And there were other people who talked to me on the side but said they could not talk about it during that time, where they opposed the dam from the beginning. They liked canoeing. They liked, you know, the woods and their cropland and things. But they said, you know, there was this majority or very vocal group that wanted the dam,
right,
and the economic development that came with it. And so they felt like they couldn't really say anything. And a lot of the landowners that I talked to said that many people thought they were doing right by the community, you know, that they were doing the right thing by helping downstream communities not have the flooding issues repeated so many times. So it really is just that heartbreaking story that,
right,
you just, yeah.
There
was no right answer, you
know? It's hard to put yourself and your family in that position. Like, what would you have done? What side of the issue would you have been on? And things like that,
exactly,
too. And, you know, through the many decades that we talked about, from the Depression on, you know, through the 60s and into the 70s, you know, the many different economic cycles that have gone through, where farming is profitable, farming's not profitable, you know, recreational land is valuable, recreational vandal, you know, isn't valuable. So, you know, we see that to this day yet, where if we think about our own lifetimes and how many times things change, so
yeah,
that, you know, those values continue to change as well. So, but we went through this. We had these families that either sold or were quite, you know, forced off their land, and the Corps of Engineers now owned the property, and they came in and took down farm buildings and stuff like that once the people left, and got ready to make it a lake. Am I right there? And what years were those?
In a way, I mean, okay, you have to think in like multi categories here, because yes, the Corps of Engineers was focused on taking down the buildings, and some people had the option to move the houses, and some of those houses that were moved still exist in the valley. There's other folks that can point them out to you. Some people got to go harvest their timber, for example, or they could, you know, reclaim as much as they could off of what was sold. And then at the same time, you had like this highway reconstruction study, because Highway 131 would have been at the bottom of the lake. So with the highway reconstruction, you have these archaeological surveys come about. And so the initial surveys showing how many incredible archaeological sites are in the valley was way back in the 70s. You had Hugh Iltis from UW-Madison canoeing the Kickapoo River and documenting the incredible diverse plant life, bird life, the just ecological gem that exists in this. And then, of course, the environmental movement of the early 70s, you know, our first Earth Day, our first requirement for an environmental impact statement. So all these things are going on simultaneously. At the same time, the Corps of Engineers is spending a lot of money, and Congress was keeping an eye on that, apparently.
So spending a lot of money actually starting to create the dam, starting to move dirt.
Yeah, and purchasing and then starting to move dirt, the berm, three quarters of the way done. That tower couldn't have been cheap.
Right.
110-foot concrete tower with, copper fixings in the center.
And all of this is still visible. You know, if you go out to the Kickapoo Valley Reserve, you can go into the visitor center there and kind of find out where all of this is. But all of this, like I said, the dam, the berm, the tower itself is still physically all there. So if you want to learn more on that and actually see it, absolutely go out and do it. So who were the political players at the time that all of this was coming to a head to the point of where they decided to not go through with the dam? And, you know, what were those years, or what years were they?
Okay, so now, remember, my friend, I was in grade school at the time.
Okay, you weren't out there?
I probably wasn't paying as close of attention to politics at the time. But so you had characters like, Governor Lucy, Senator Nelson, William Proxmire, all of these people who really had or would leave a legacy of environmental involvement. But prior to that, they were definitely convinced that this dam would have fixed a lot of problems in their community,
district,
in their district. So, in that era, I think when I first started the job, people told me a lot of times that it was the politicians that flipped their vote or flipped their support. But again, it was all of these other things kind of coming together that had to be resolved.
Right, but there had to have been a date or a time when they said it's off, like we're not doing it. Do you recall that at all?
Well, I read a lot about
that.
Okay. So there was so much scrutiny of the environmental impact statement. So Water Resources Development Act, which is this huge piece of federal legislation every couple of years, the Water Resources Development Act creates the dam and the whole project, and it is requiring, or the Environmental Protection Act requires an environmental impact statement. So the first environmental impact statement on a nearly 9,000-acre project is 10 pages long. And the Corps of Engineers basically says, yep, this is
good enough.
This is going to put some stuff underwater, but it's much better for the community. So, and again, I hate to say it, but you kind of empathize with the Corps of Engineers because they were told to build a dam.
Right.
You know, that was authorized. They were told to protect these people, and that's what they were trained to do.
Right. Yeah, I mean, we're not here to throw anyone under the bus. We're here to tell the story.
Okay.
So we're not choosing sides here at this point in time.
Well, so. And again, it just, you know, I wasn't there. So anyway, the environmental impact statements gets challenged. The environmental movement really takes off, and the Sierra Club files the first lawsuit that the Corps of Engineers has to redo the environmental impact statement, and that they did. And in that time period and soon after is when the politicians said, okay, we're over budget, this might not work. And how they figured out it might not work is they contract the Corps of Engineers through a congressional directive required a study from UW-Madison. And so I had the opportunity to interview a gentleman who was a student at the time and later became a professor. But he said that you felt like, you know, you were delivering the news at the funeral. But for two seasons, they studied, they tried to model what the lake would look like. And they also were able to calculate how much erosion was coming off the hills. You know, and we all of us who live around here know that it's a huge problem. And traditional farming practices before conservation would really dump a lot of soil in. So this team of graduate students and their lead professors study all of this, like just in this intense, he said it was just nonstop, just intense work. And they come out with this report saying this is going to be very shallow, probably very stagnant. It's not going to match the artist's rendition.
Not going to be pretty.
Yeah, bad news.
Yeah. Very bad news, I'm sure, for many people at that time. So just want to take a quick break here, remind folks that you are listening to WDRT 91.9 FM in Viroqua. My name is Steve Brandl. The name of the show is Conversations. Today we're talking to Marcy West. Marcy is the author of a book that just came out, which is named Protecting Paradise and the Driftless. Marcy was the first executive director at the Kickapoo Valley Reserve and served there for a long time. So we want to thank Marcy for being here. So, okay, we're back. Marcy, thanks for being here. So we talked a lot. We kind of set the stage, told the story of how the dam project evolved, and then in the 70s, it came to a stop. And basically, everybody picked up their tools and went home. Am I correct there? And what happened to the land then between the time when the Corps of Engineers left and the Kickapoo Valley Reserve came to be? Tell us that portion of the puzzle.
Okay, so construction stopped in 1975. Corps of Engineers was over budget, environmental impacts, and this study that said it wouldn't necessarily be a nice lake. So the most visual of that for folks is if you are heading north on 131 and have to take that sharp turn into Rockton and go over that Rockton Bridge, that's where construction stopped. You know, had it kept going, 131 would have stayed out of the valley that way, and that bridge would have been over the lake. But anyway, so if you need a visual, that's where it is. From 75 until 93 became known as no man's land. So the people living in the area were still driving the same roads and things like that, but they would go past this very, very vacant land. And obviously, it didn't have nearly the trees that it has now. But the area, it came to be known as kind of that no man's land. It was termed the government land. And folks got word that there was no oversight. And so off-road trucks, the early ATVs, the three-wheelers, just went wherever they wanted to. Horseback riding was allowed. There was some folks who squatted on the land, and it was just very much vacant, so to speak. And the Corps of Engineers did rent some of the farmland back, and that was obviously very hurtful because sometimes it was the previous landowners renting their own land back. Yeah, ouch. So then in the early 90s, and in that interim, there were, you know, politicians that wanted to find a resolution. Former Congressman Steve Gunderson initiated a cost-benefit analysis on a smaller dam, what the alternatives were, things like that. Nothing would succeed as far as the cost-benefit ratio. You know, as you can imagine, construction would continue to climb. And the Kickapoo continued to flood. So The design, that kind of thing, got studied but didn't work out. So as I understand it, the final straw was a very typical march in Wisconsin, March of 1993, when you have the thawing from winter, the freeze-thaw effect, and you had a number of people coming out on a nice weekend and just burning up and down the hills and tearing it up. And, you know, again, there were folks who had moved into the area because of the beauty, because of the scenery, and for the love of the river, and they wanted something to happen. This just couldn't go on. The Corps of Engineers was not paying taxes reliably to the local government. There was really nowhere for it to go as far as economic development went at that point. So these folks came together and started talking about what the options were. And, you know, Brian Root will tell the story that it was literally in somebody's living room one night, somebody else's shop the next, and you just kept talking to people and getting ideas about what could be done. And one of the things that a lot of people said to me when I started was they should have sold the land back to the original landowners, and that couldn't be done because it was purchased with public dollars. So you can't just, you know, sell it back to one individual once you have public dollars involved. So so
you had to put it out for bid or something? Is that what you're saying?
Right.
Yep. And Brian Root is who?
Former Senator Brian Rood, yep.
State
he
senator?
Was a state senator for this district for many years, and then we'll get to that point of how crucial he was and the bipartisanship. And that's one of the themes of the story is bipartisanship, which I really like to be able to talk about in that project. So, yeah, you had these very this very grassroots organization. You had another group that was still challenging. They wanted the dam built. There were lawsuits, things like that. Corps of Engineers had since then been pulled to other projects. And but that authorization for a dam still hung out there. So what came together was Tommy Thompson, you know, former Governor Tommy Thompson, but when he was in the assembly, he was from Elroy, and he had heard this story over and over again, wanted to get something done. Senator Brian Rood, former Assemblyman Dwayne Johns Rood. So they, and, you know, they had ideas, I think, about certain aspects of it, and the Lower Wisconsin Riverway Board had been established, and there were other boards in the state, but it sounded like this citizens group really had some good ideas about keeping a property public, having a local board manage a public property. All of those things just, they were a thread from beginning to end.
And so, most of these folks were from the Valley? They were from Lafarge, Ontario, Westby? I mean, just...
Yeah. I mean, some of them, the list on the original plan were all names that people recognize. You know, the George Wilbers, the Roseanne Boyettes, Ron Johnsons.
Sure.
So as they came together and as they started looking at this, you know, having the right elected officials makes all the difference. And Governor Thompson appointed Al Anderson of UW Extension for a special project. And everybody loved UW Extension at the time, right? You know, we all had our county agents and stuff, and they were the good guys. And Al was just awesome at pulling things together. And they pulled a proposal together that basically wrote itself as far as legislation goes. The Corps of Engineers agreed, or Congress told the Corps of Engineers that they would transfer the property to the state and Ho-Chunk Nation, and that's what happened. But, you know, the whole, we got to get into the whole Ho-Chunk Nation involvement as well. And so that discussion came in, again, because those archaeological sites were so significant, because this is the original territory for you know, a variety of tribes used the area, but the Ho-Chunk Nation being right here and having such an incredible presence when you learn more about those archaeological sites and the cultural history that was so important to them in Southwest Wisconsin.
So they are joint managers of the KVR, or are they? Do they have their own portion of it that they govern?
Yeah, that was. So you have the federal directive for the transfer has this list of things that we had to get through, and one of them was the memorandum of understanding and the management plan with the Ho-Chunk Nation, which had never been done before. But it is joint management. So they have a number of members on the board, but they also have joint management with 8,600 acres. And the 1,200 acres that's held in trust is those areas where there was significance, and they selected for a number of reasons. But so the joint management is the whole 8,600 acres, and then the trust land is 1,200 acres within that 86.
Okay. The local community decided that they were going to try to get their arms around this land and get it transferred and do something with it. Was it always clear, or when did it come to the point where they said, okay, we're going to be looking for a director, this is the plan? Or did they want a director that would bring a plan in? Is that was your, you got hired, obviously, is kind of the end of the story, but did you have to come in with a proposal of what to do for the land, or were you there to implement a plan that was in place?
I was there to implement, with the board, I was there to implement the plan that grassroots community group had developed, and then the elected officials took it into legislative reality. So at the federal level, there's stuff going on with the Water Resources Development Act of 96 that actually transfers it and had to deauthorize it. So, you know, they authorized it to be built before, and then they had to deauthorize it to really end it. And at the state level, that plan became the outline for the legislation that created the board and outlined the authority of the board and what the goal and objective of the reserve was. And, you know, one of the things that I talk about, and I correct people all the time, is people want to call it a preserve or a park. You work at the park. And it's like, no, they were really specific. They wanted it to be a reserve. The Kickapoo Valley Reserve means, out of those original documents, that it's not preserved like nobody can touch it, and it's not a park like anybody can abuse it. That it's that in-between where it's so full of really cool stuff that we're going to protect it and call it a reserve.
Okay. And are there other examples of that that most people might know of in the state or nation that they decided to do a reserve rather than a preserve or a park?
Yeah, they're like Mead Wildlife Reserve in central Wisconsin, very similar, where you're not necessarily that park that's providing all the services, but you're also not so, you know, inclined. You can manage it with protection in mind. You know, and that was one of the things with a reserve. One of the first big arguments was off-road vehicles and the ATVs and off-road trucks. And so with the reserve and with the knowledge of the environmental and archaeological significance, that motorized vehicles weren't going to be allowed. But, you know, human-powered is allowed.
Bikes and skiing.
Bikes, hiking.
Silent sports, yeah, exactly. Things like that. Okay, and so what was Marcy West doing at this time that all these great ideas were coming together from the local community? I mean, you were hired as the first executive director. I'm assuming you were in that line of work. Tell us about that.
Yeah, actually, we were in Madison in 1996, and I was working for the Federation of Cooperatives. I was a lobbyist, the L word, that, yeah. I had graduated in natural resource management and worked for nonprofits and then the Federation of Cooperatives. And we, like I said, fell in love with Wildcat Mountain State Park. We just accidentally, not accidentally, but it was one of the places that we got to visit. Dave had been working at Sauk County Land Conservation Department, so a well-known name, Jeff Hastings, of Westby fame, gets credit for bringing us here and introducing us to it. We got to canoe the river when you were still sliding down the muddy slopes.
And, oh, boy.
Yeah, but I fell in love with it. And then Dave was wrapping up his graduate program, and I saw the advertisement in the paper. Remember when the classifieds were lines long, and it's like, oh my God, this is near Wildcat. We could live there.
Right.
You know, we wanted to be rural.
Okay, living the dream. And was the whole Kickapoo Valley situation something that was known statewide? I mean, was everybody aware of it, or was it kind of like, I don't know, something's happening over in the Lafarge area? Wow, you don't want to get involved in that? Or was it very much like a sought-after position?
Oh, boy, that's a really good question. I think there were certain people in the state that knew a lot about it. And it had gotten national attention when the dam construction stopped and other things. It would be a mixed bag. But no, the folks in the area knew about it, and once you started talking to them, you knew that it had been quite difficult. And because I was working on legislative issues in Madison, I knew Senator Brian Rood, and I knew he would be able to tell me what it was, whether it'd be worth applying for or mm-hmm. not. And he's a great storyteller, and he will tell the story that he tried to warn me. But no, it was, you know, again, he really wanted it to make progress. He had nothing but good to say about the community involvement, because it had gotten to a point where that plan was actually taken to every level of government and garnered support. So that community grassroots plan for this idea of a board managing a public property got all kinds of support, and they knew the time was right. But you know, there were a lot of unknowns, and the position description did not fully explain what I would be doing other than working for a board for the state of Wisconsin.
So you came in, you got the job, we're lucky that you did. You came walking into your first day of work, and what was the plan? I mean, you have a beautiful facility out there now. Was that always the case? Did you always know you had funding to do the many improvements that were done? You know, was, like I said, the usage that, you know, was going to be a non-motorized reserve, did all that have to get hashed through, or it was done and you just got to start implementing, start beating back the trees and clearing the paths? Or tell us about that what year was it?
1997. I started in December of 96, but we lived in Madison, and I would drive out in 1997 once the snow melted, and the first part of the job was to figure out where the boundaries were. Because if you look at the reserve on a map right now, imagine that just after 30 years of overgrowth and you know, abandoned roads and partial buildings and dump sites and some other things. So coming out for the early board meetings, I would work in the community center room for a while. There was no office. Board members were generous enough to let me stay at their house. And then I would drive back because, you know, we had a six-month-old baby at home. But it was really trying to figure out how that transfer was going to happen, how the memorandum of understanding would get done, and the board setting up policies. We came up with an agreement for the Corps of Engineers to allow the state to manage the property even prior to official transfer. So we kind of came up with yet another management plan early on in the policies. And again, it was all led by that statutory drafting that was based off of that community proposal.
Sure, sure. And the funding for the KVR, is that something that you have to pitch every year, or how does that work?
Yeah. Well, we started out with a base allocation, it's called. So in the state budget, which is a two-year budget, so we don't have to pitch every year. But the base allocation covered staff salaries and eventually an office. But, I mean, as I say in the book, it was just genius that the revenue that is taken in by the reserve stays with the reserve. It does, you know, like if you think about state parks, Devil's Lake has millions of people attend. So they get a lot of funding, and then some of our other parks don't get as much. So with the reserve, it was like you had this goal of, okay, if we want to do an education program, we got to come up with some funding ideas, some revenue generating, and then that revenue stayed with us. Or grant writing, the covered bridge, all of the timber bridges were based on a grant that matched state funding and things like that. So it was a combination of state dollars. And again, that was really a great idea of getting a segregated fund in the budget item that is pretty safe in state government. You're not at the whim of how the economy's doing or things like that. Your base allocation was pretty safe. And then, yeah, the rest of it, as we went for the visitor center and things like that, that's when big dollars came into play.
Well, again, we want to thank Marcy for joining us. You're listening to WDRT 91.9 FM in Viroqua. I'm Steve Brandle. The name of the show is Conversations. It happens every Thursday morning at 9 a.m. You might be listening to it now. If not, you can listen to it in our archives if you go to wdrt.org. Go to archives, look for Conversations. We have a rotating group of volunteer people that come on in and interview different folks about different topics. You can also see us on Vernon County, VernonCom, Channel 17. We certainly appreciate Marcy for being here today. She's talking about her new book, which is called Protecting Paradise in the Driftless. And we're talking about how the Kickapoo Valley Reserve came to be. Okay, so again, Marcy, thanks for all the information that you're sharing with us today. But so we're up to the point where the visitor center is built and the Kickapoo Valley Reserve is happening. Policies are set. People are camping. The facility and the grounds continue to improve. And after 25 years, you retired, and congratulations on that. And you decided to write about it. So tell us why you decided to write the book.
I was encouraged to write the book by the dean of the Institute for Environmental Studies with UW-Madison, who came out for a tour and it, you know, was a tour I'd given 1,000 times before. But he said, and I think that's one of the things that people kind of don't realize unless you work there, is the variety of people who come and visit the reserve, like from all over the world, from all over the nation, and especially these students. And so Wisconsin history, these kind of projects, he just felt really strongly needed to be told. And I was at a point in my life, and actually the board let me start working on it before I left, but it was just one of those things where it's like, oh yeah, this is a really incredible story. The agreement with the Ho-Chunk Nation is so unique. The ecology of the reserve is so precious. And this management style of a majority of people who reside within the valley setting policy and working with a sovereign nation to do so is just really unique. And I think we kind of miss that sometimes, those of us who live here, like, oh yeah, that is really special.
Right, right. And what would you say are some of the take-homes from the book? Like, what are you hoping to share with us on that?
Yeah, I'm hoping that people first get an appreciation for how unique it is and also how fragile it is. I share a story of what could have changed really rapidly in 2015. And so these places that we have that are so special are so fragile, and it really does take the community that lives around it to protect it, and our elected officials to want to protect it. And so I just, you know, looking into the future, what's the future of protecting paradise? And it's like, it's gotta be the same. It's just like those grassroots folks that started the plan. You know, now we've got 11 board members, and folks have to be willing to serve on the board. We have to have a very dedicated staff. We have to have, you know, a ton of volunteers, as you know, to make these places work. And I think it's worth it for the community.
So, yeah, besides that, too, how about if you're a member of the community and want to be helpful, you know, protect that. Understanding the issues at hand and voting is probably a big part of it. Making sure that something like the KVR is supported through that, and then just volunteering when you see those options out there, I guess, huh? Is there anything else that I'm missing right on there?
Right. Now, with the federal and state connection, we have to have elected officials that support us, and we've been fortunate, and it's been bipartisan throughout. And then, I mean, the Friends of KVR are just amazing, and they do so many great things, the education program, but also getting out there and helping with invasive weeds and other things. It's just a monumental task. So, you know, we all do our part.
Sure. And that's just as simple as reaching out to the folks at the front desk at the KVR and learning what's coming up and following their social media, getting involved, joining there's the Friends of the Reserve as well, which is a great group that really gets you involved with the KVR. So that's wonderful as well. Now, I know with the book, this is brand, this just hot off the press, right? Is that what we got?
Yeah. It came out in end of September, so.
Okay. And you have several book talks coming up as well in the next while. Tell us about those. What's going on out there?
Well, on November 9th, I will be at the Kickapoo Valley Reserve, and I have some special guests coming with me to talk about their perspective on how it came to be. So Saturday, November 9th at 10 a.m., and we'll wrap up, and folks can still go out and enjoy their Saturday. And then I will be in Viroqua November 20th at 2 p.m. At the Viroqua Library with the Over 50s group, I think it's called.
Yeah. Okay, lunch and learn, or is that? Yeah.
No, it's an afternoon thing, so I knew I fit the Over 50s bill, okay. So that'll be fun.
What else in closing? I guess we have a few minutes yet, Marcy. Anything else that we've forgotten or overlooked that we should be talking about yet?
Well, I think it's really important for community organizations like the Kickapoo Valley Reserve, like WTRT's community radio. The Valley is just so lucky to have so many interesting features, and I really encourage people to get out and enjoy them.
Okay. Well, thanks for being here, Marcy. We look forward to reading your book and learning more about it, taking in some of your book talks that you have coming up. Appreciate you being here. Appreciate the many years that you dedicated to the Kickapoo Valley Reserve. And we look forward to hopefully getting you back and talking more in the future. Again, this is WDRT 91.9 FM. Hope to be talking to you soon. Have a great week.